Hello, I'm Jimmy and welcome back to Steeped in History. This is the third episode of our podcast and this is a long one. This is the first hour-long episode. Goodness me, I thought that these were going to be half an hour long, but of course when you get people who love history talking about history together, they tend to go over the time limit a little bit. So this is our first hour-long episode and you will notice that the audio quality is a bit different between this introduction, the middle and the outro, and that is because during my conversation with my lovely friend Dr. Chelsea Rutke, the laptop that I was recording on decided to not recognize my podcasting microphone. So I was just talking like I am now into my podcast mic, concentrating on keeping my face the right distance away from the microphone, and the whole time it was just recording off my headphones. So thank you to my friend Sam for helping edit some of the audio for today's episode. I hope that you still enjoy it. Thank you so much to everybody who has already left reviews and shared the podcast. I've been told off for not doing this, so I'm going to do this up at the top end. So if you would like to support the podcast or my YouTube channel, The Welsh Viking, financially, there is a Patreon page, which is linked in the description of the podcast, and it is patreon.com/JimmyJohnson, which is me, my lovely alliterative name, JIMMYJOHNSON. So there. And yeah, let's jump in. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Dr. Chelsea Rutke.
That's how I speak.
I mean, that's how I've always known you to speak.
That's how you always know me to speak. I've always spoken like that. If anybody says that it's not, they are lying. A horrible, horrible lie.
I mean, that's what I'm going to talk about today.
Oh, is that your subject? Your chosen subject is the horrible lies that people tell about my voice?
Yes, it is. I'm going to talk about a very important year. That year is this year. And obviously the most criminal thing is people lying about your voice.
Absolutely. It could be, yeah, there could be nothing more criminal that has happened this year than people telling porkies about me.
Absolutely nothing else comes to mind.
Nothing else comes to mind, in particular in your homeland where you currently are.
In fact, I'm teaching my students all about how illicit presses in the past ran just so we could counteract bad narratives about your voice.
Ah, thank you. You're doing good work. You're doing God's work.
But which side's God?
But which God? All right, I'll start doing the actual things now then, shall I?
Okay.
Excellent. All right. I will do an intro and then we'll just get into it. That sounds all right.
Good.
Hell yeah. All right. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. Welcome to Steeped in History. It is me. I am Jimmy. I do most of the things on the podcast except play the music because I can't be bothered. And today I have a very special guest, which is friend of the podcast, which is the first time I've ever been able to say that. So this is very exciting. And excellent human being all around. I have Dr. Chelsea Rutke, who is a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Utah's History Department. Hi, Chelsea.
Hi, Jimmy. You do go by Jimmy on the pod, right? Not James.
I'm Jimmy. I'm only James if I'm in lots of trouble.
Well, then you might be James today. We'll see.
I might be James today. We'll see how things go. But yeah, I'm generally Jimmy. I'm Jimmy. I'm Jimmy online. That's my brand. Yeah.
I miss you. How are you doing?
I miss you too. I'm fine. I've got a podcast now.
You do, and I am a podcast friend.
Yay! Hey, podcast friend. Oh my goodness me. Amazing. So, first things and most important things first. What kind of tea are you drinking? I know you have a pot of tea on the go because you told me that before we started recording. What are you drinking?
I am a Earl Grey fan. I love every version of Earl Grey, and I've got about 5 different kinds of Earl Grey, swapping out the corn flour or adding in some extra bits. So today I am on the Earl Grey Moonlight, ooh, which has vanilla and cream notes to it. That lovely traditional Earl Grey.
Delightful. I love a cream of Earl Grey. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's real good. Oh, so nice. Who makes that?
It's by Adagio Tea, and I am the fancy loose leaf girl, so this was brewed loose, and it steeped in my pot for 5 minutes.
Five minute loose leaf cream of Earl Grey. Whoa. Are you drinking it neat? Are you milking it?
Oh, always milking it.
Always milking it. It is the classy way to drink Earl Grey, and I won't be corrected on that.
I will stand on this hill.
Thank you. I'm not taking questions at this time. Mm-hmm. Awesome. So have you got any fun books that you're reading right now? They don't have to be workbooks, because you are a postdoc fellow in a history department, mm-hmm. and you have teaching things and you have to read lots and write lots. So it doesn't have to be workbooks, but equally, if the only books you have time for right now are workbooks, that is fine.
Definitely a lot of workbooks, but I have been rereading the Thursday Murder Club series.
Oh, the Richard Osman books.
Yes.
Super cool.
Getting more and more friends into them, so then we did a little Thursday Murder book club.
Oh, that's so lovely. Did you do it on Thursday?
We tried. It's been on Saturdays.
That's fine. It's fine. It's a club. That's one of the three. One out of three ain't bad. It's not on Thursdays. Nobody got murdered, but it's still a club.
Thursday, it's Saturday, the Thursday of the weekend. Saturday. Don't think that makes sense, but we'll just say it.
Amazing. Yeah, I'm going with that. That works for me. Saturday is the third day. Saturday, I can't even say it. Saturday is the Thursday of the weekend. You know that old saying?
Oh, yeah. Now, I do have to throw out to you what I have been reading for my postdoc, because I have been reading up on the history of Welsh printing presses. So obviously, I have to share that with you.
Ooh, of course you have to share that with me. That's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
I've been obsessed with the a secret press that was probably operated out of a cave in Little Orm, way up north. We know of at least one book, Catholic book, that was printed on this secret press in 1587. But it had a fake imprint. It lied. It said that it was printed in Rouen in 1585. So that's what I've been looking at.
Oh my god, that's so cool. Secret Catholic books being printed on the Little Orm. That's mm-hmm. wild. I know exactly where that cave is as well. I think there's only one cave that it could be.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Ooh. Just,
I love this story.
That's so cool. And when's that from?
1587.
Ooh. That's really cool. That's so fascinating. I didn't know you were going to tell me about that, and now I am fully writing it down so that I can try and jump down that rabbit hole.
Yes, it's been in my pocket for when I talk to you.
Oh, I love it. And that is, hang on, 1587, I think that's not long after the first Welsh language Bible was printed.
Mm-hmm.
When was the first one? I should know this off by heart. My mind wants to say 15. My mind is saying 15. My mind wants to say the year before, but I think it was 1588. I think it was 1588 when William Morgan's...
It is 1588.
Oh, William Morgan's first Bible, 1588. God, I'm good.
Mm-hmm.
I was listening in primary school history.
I feel like it's not that far away from Holywell, where we know there was a Jesuit institution, and a bit north of where there was a secret Jesuit library that was quote unquote discovered by authorities in 1679.
Ooh, secret libraries. Yeah, Holywell's not far away at all. It's just down the coast. It's quite nice. There's still a holy well there. You can still go to the well. And I think it's mentioned in the first Brother Cadwyle book.
Yes, I think so.
Right? Because they don't go to Holywell. They go to somewhere else. to get the bones for the saint. If nobody listening to this has read any of the Brother Cadwyle books, A, what's wrong with you? And B, go and read the Brother Cadwyle books because they're really, really good.
They're so wonderful. That's what my cat is named.
Yeah, they're so wonderful that your cat is named after. Exactly. Exactly. They're wrong. Yeah, I can't remember where they go. They go somewhere near the Conwy Valley. They're somewhere like Panditidir or somewhere like that. It's not Panditidir or like Hafodinos, but it's around there somewhere. Oh, this is so fascinating because I don't think of... Because when I was doing my PhD stuff, I was looking at North Wales in the 18th century. So it's all like the start of nonconformism and chapels and independence and stuff like that. And then I suddenly get transported by you 200 years back and I'm like, oh God, yeah, there were Catholic libraries and secret printing being done. It's so cool. The land, like the religious landscape's so different. Super cool. Oh my goodness. So speaking of secret Catholics and all of the things that I know that you love to talk and teach people about, because that is one of the things that you talk about is 16th and 17th century religion and politics in Britain. What is your year of interest that you want to share on the podcast? Yep.
Well, I've actually already dropped the year at one point. The year I want to discuss is 1679.
Ooh, a great year. So why are we looking at 1679?
Well, Jimmy, have you heard of the Popish Plot?
I'm gonna be honest and say yes, I have, because we've talked about it before, but lots of people listening won't have heard of the Popish Plot. So tell us about the Popish Plot of 1679 and why it's interesting to Chelsea's.
So I need to back up slightly to the end of 1678. I hope this isn't cheating. But former Catholic priest named Titus Oates strolls up to a justice of the peace in London claiming that he knows of a plot. Ooh. He then testifies that, you'll never believe this, the Catholics are conspiring. They are going to murder Charles II, who was the king at the time, and put his brother and heir on the throne. And his brother was, in fact, Catholic, James. So they kill the king, put the king's Catholic brother on the throne, then have an uprising where they slaughter all of the Protestants in London and then across England. And this will be accompanied by an invasion of the French or the Spanish coming over from Ireland.
Chelsea, this sounds incredible and dangerous and frightening and like a matter of national security. This sounds so serious.
Well, that's not what the Justice of the Peace thought. He dutifully took down this plot and then just rolled his eyes and went about his day. This very much sounds like a stock narrative. But, a little while later, that Justice of the Peace is found murdered.
Oh, knife in his back, face down in a river, I hope.
No, sword in his front.
Oh, that's even, okay, yeah, that's still pretty cool. All right, yeah, no, that's fine.
And actually, that murder is unsolved to this day.
No way, really?
Really, really, we do not know.
Oh, wow.
Now, of course, at the time, once this happens, this becomes proof positive that that plot was real.
Of course.
All of London, most of England, is convinced that the Popish Plot, as it's dubbed, is a real, and as you said, threat. But I'm going to give away the secret. All of this is completely and utterly made up.
Oh, so none of the French aren't going to invade from Ireland. There's no secret plan to murder all the Protestants. No, it's all BS.
It's all absolutely made up. It's all just coming from tropes of anti-Catholic, anti-Popish stories. So from previous events that have happened, like the Spanish Armada, from things like the gunpowder plot, where Catholics did try to blow up Parliament several decades earlier. So it's drawing on these tropes, but yeah, completely, completely made up. There's no truth to this.
Okay, so what happens to Oates?
Oates becomes a hero. Everyone believes this. So Oates is raised up as, you know, the whistleblower, the warning, and it basically becomes a crime to contest what he says. And this is made even crazier because he keeps changing the plot. So as the plot picks up speed, he also gets other conspirators who are confessing that they overheard the plot. So we have Israel Tongue and Miles Prance, who's a silversmith, and they're saying, oh yes, we have heard people whispering about this plot. And did you know that the queen is involved? And in fact, they have been plotting this at her palace at Somerset House. And actually, she's going to try to poison the king herself.
That's amazing. Can we also take a moment to just appreciate how good everybody's names are in this? Like Titus, yes. Oates. Oh, what's your name? Tongue. Shut up. Oates and Tongue.
I should mention, too, the poor Justice of the Peace who was murdered. His name was Sir Edmund Barry Godfrey.
Excellent. That's three first names for a name.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Love that.
And, sorry, he's a magistrate. I keep saying Justice of the Peace, but he's a magistrate. And then you also have the man who kind of backs Oates quite a bit. His name is Anthony Ashley Cooper, the first Earl of Shaftesbury. So just brilliant names across the board.
Ooh, oh, so we've got, oh, we've got, so we've got an earl. So we've got a peer. We've got a nobleman investing in all of this.
Everyone gets drawn into this plot because not only is 1679, like the first year of this Popish plot hysteria. But remember that Catholic brother, James?
Yes.
So he is the heir to the throne. Charles II does not have any legitimate children. And Parliament does not like that there is a Catholic heir to the throne. So they have been trying to block him. And they use this plot as the huge momentum to do this. And so at the same time we have the Popish plot, we get the expulsion crisis.
Oh my God, there's so much going on.
The exclusion crisis. I need more tea.
So the exclusion crisis is going on at the same time as all of this. What's that? So what's the exclusion crisis?
So the exclusion crisis is an attempt by Parliament to exclude James, the Duke of York, the brother of Charles II, from the line of succession. They want them to skip over James and go to his Protestant daughters after Charles dies.
Wow, there's so much drama going on.
Oh, yes. And that group is led by the Earl of Shaftesbury, Anthony Ashley Cooper. So he is the one who is pressing that charge in Parliament. Now, the king does not like this, so he dismisses Parliament in 1679. But in so doing, Parliament gets the last laugh because they refuse to renew the censorship law, which is called the Licensing Act. So when they're dismissed, there is suddenly no official censorship in London while everyone is having a massive hysteria over this giant fake news story.
Oh, wow.
So the chaos grows.
Oof. Yeah, I could believe it. This is mad. This sounds kind of eerily similar to things like fake news causing phantom rioting in today's society. Like, this is one of those amazing parallels where looking at the past can tell you exactly how to avoid things happening in the present day. Like,
Absolutely.
Like not believing fake news, do a bit of research and you'll see that there aren't any boats full of French people coming to murder you all.
Yeah, and everyone starts pumping out ballads and pamphlets. Again, people are growing the plot more and more. It actually, the ideas of the plot make it onto playing cards, which are then distributed at coffee houses. So now everyone's gambling and learning what the plot is.
Incredible. This is brilliant. You have chosen a very good year.
Thank you. I mean, very good in the fact that it's a very bad year.
It's a very bad year. Yeah, I bet there was, not very much time for anything else in anybody's minds. But
No.
woof.
And I mean, everyone's talking about it, everyone's believing it. And so people start reporting on their Catholic neighbors, people that they have been fine with till now, but this suddenly turns their neighbors into that scary, foreign, suspicious, treasonous other. And they're like, oh, maybe they're involved in the plot. So people are getting brought before Parliament to give testimony. People are getting arrested. There are new laws on Catholics. So there's the 5 Mile Act, which says you can't travel more than 5 miles from your home if you're Catholic without a special permit.
What? So Roman Catholic people basically had to be chaperoned if they wanted to go more than 5 miles away. That's crazy. That's
Yes.
mad. That's absolutely mad. And is it still? So is it still? I know that at one point in the 16th century, it was fully illegal to practice Roman Catholicism, to have Roman Catholic people in your house. Is that still the situation in 1679, or have things relaxed a little bit?
Technically, that is still the exact same situation. It is still based on the laws. It's illegal to practice Catholicism. However, we no longer have kind of the high executions that we did under Elizabeth. Things have chilled out. There are known Catholics. Again, the king's brother.
Right.
His wife is a Catholic. That's why she's accused of being part of the plot. There are Catholics who are peers, but there's still restrictions on you can't be part, you can't be an officer in the military. You can't hold high office. So there's
Wow.
informal toleration, but there's still a lot of rules on the book banning these things. Popish books, widely conceived, are banned. Though that's a whole nuanced topic that you should read my book about.
Oh, you happen to very casually throw in a little book plug there.
Just a little. Catholic Print Networks in Restoration London, 1660 to 1688.
Catholic Print Networks in Restoration London. Excellent. We will put that in the description of the podcast. So if anybody wants to go and check it out, they can go and read up about book networks. It is fascinating because you've talked with me about this before. It's fascinating how these networks developed of Catholics printing books, sharing books, and basically worshipping in secret, right? Still practicing Roman Catholicism, but completely in secret and under the radar, so that they didn't, I mean, at one point, so that they didn't get executed, but so that they weren't being arrested. And it's wild that they were doing this whilst there are laws in place that mean, oh, I need to go 6 miles down the road. Cool. Somebody has to literally walk with you because you're a Roman, because you're the wrong kind of Christianity. Absolutely
Yes.
wild.
Yeah, walk with you or give you a little written pass saying you have permission. So if you're stopped, you can present your papers.
Wow.
Now again, there's a lot of difference between the written law and the lived reality. So a lot of these things weren't firmly enforced, but in 1679, a lot of them suddenly are enforced. So that 5 Catholic peers who are arrested. So everyone has known they're Catholic, but now they're arrested, charged with treason and being part of the plot. One of those figures will be executed, the Earl of Stratford.
Oh, so he's killed for plotting.
Yes, which
for
is
being a part of this magic thing.
yes.
But it's not real.
It's not real. It's not real. All of this is made up, and you get the return of priests, Catholic priests being executed, especially Jesuits. So it's about 40 people are executed for being conspirators in this made-up plot.
And but that has to go through the courts, and there has to be a trial, and there has to be evidence. Surely there has to be all of that before you can just, I don't know, I imagine either hang or lop somebody's head off. I mean, if it's treason, hanging, drawing, and quartering, I assume.
I mean, in this case, for the priests, being a priest, according to Elizabethan statute, is evidence enough of being a traitor.
Oh, they were still going by Roman Catholicism equals treason. Oh my God. Oh no. Oh, that is a sudden and very sad turn.
Another
Oh
one of
no.
executed men is the secretary to James, the Duke of York, the heir to the throne. In his case, they found papers on him that showed that he had been communicating with Rome and with France. So he is that is taken as evidence of the plot, and he is executed.
Absolutely wild. Wow. Oh, so he was writing letters, and that confirms. That's crazy. Oh my
And
goodness me.
I should say that while I'm focusing on 1679, these events are taking place kind of from 1679 through 1681 and even into 1683. So this isn't even like a blip where everything gets really heightened. This hysteria really survived for a couple of years.
Wow, yeah, like 3 or 4 years of people just going wild with this fantasy theory. That's unbelievable. I mean, and yet it's not unbelievable at all, because that's exactly what happens now, right? We still have people who believe in conspiracy theories for years and years and years, despite all evidence to the contrary. You know,
Exactly.
people reading newspaper articles that are clearly bunk, but that don't then get debunked, and so they just carry on having that belief. Like, you have to have a belief challenged for you to change it. So, oh wow. So, okay, so people have now died because of this plot that doesn't exist.
Yes,
How
and others
does.
forced into exile. Many people flee abroad if they can afford it, because they fear they might be next up on the chopping block.
Yeah, of course. Wow. So there's an exodus of people. People are dying. Is there ever a royal reaction to all of this? Is there ever a kind of the king puts out a statement?
There is. So the king is kind of commenting all along, and I will say Charles II is quite shrewd. He knows that this has kind of been a powder keg waiting to go off. There has been this long history in England of tension and anxiety and fear over the shape of the Church of England, over the idea of Catholicism coming back. Some of these had led just a few decades before this into a civil war. I think you've talked about a little bit of this in one of your other episodes.
Yeah, we briefly touch on the Civil Wars in episode 1. Okay, yes.
So he can't straight up deny the plot because then he could just be lumped in as, oh, well, you're part of it too. Makes sense. Your wife and your brother are Catholics. Hey, you lived in exile in France during that war. So he has to investigate the plot. And, it's not unheard of for people to be plotting against the king. So he is investigating. He does draw the line at he will not let his brother be taken out of the succession, and he will not let anyone accuse his queen, Catherine of Braganza, of trying to poison him. So we actually do get the plot backing off of that accusation because those are the two lines that he draws.
Oh, that's so interesting. So, because he basically says, I mean, he knows that this isn't a real thing, right? Presumably.
Oh yeah.
Or, they had quite a sophisticated espionage network at that point. I assume he was basically saying, yeah, this isn't real. Stop talking about my family like that. I know I'm obviously not going to get rid of my brother from the line of succession. Drop it. And people kind of go, oh, okay then. So again,
Well,
I guess it not that smoothly.
they're pushing back against James. They back off of Catherine, but I mean, they are getting to divorce Catherine at this time too. So he's focused on trying to protect his family members, in a sense. But he really can't straight up deny it. It's this fear that has been festering in the mind of the public and being nurtured for decades. And to deny it can look like inaction. And so the people who don't believe in the plot are essentially always on the defensive because the people who are promoting it keep adding to the story. So they're constantly having to address new claims, to just constantly trying to disprove what's been said.
Wow. Okay, so a lot of energy is being spent on trying to disprove all of this.
Yes. And I should say there are lots of people who never believe the plot. There's a lot of people who doubt it, but every time they try to voice it, they risk becoming targets.
Right.
There's a merchant that I've studied who gets arrested, has his shop searched, and eventually chooses to be deported to Antwerp rather than be in prison because he was overheard essentially mocking the plot in front of someone.
What? That's wild. What? This is incredible. I didn't know almost any of this. I knew a little bit about there being a made-up plot. I had no idea there was all of this mad fallout.
Oh yeah, and it goes beyond London too. So that Jesuit library in Wales that I mentioned, I know, I was seeding the plot earlier. It is quote unquote discovered in 1679, and authorities are sent to investigate it, and all of the books are seized. But there's a caveat here, and I have to shout out Hannah Thomas, and her amazing work on this library. So it seems that A, people already knew about this library. The people in the region were well aware and just weren't bothered until this hysteria kicked up. But B, somebody warned that library that the troops were coming because while they find the books, there's no people there. All the Jesuits
Oh,
escaped.
okay. Right. So everybody's gone. So they find an empty library, but that's all they find. Okay.
And
Fascinating.
then the local bishop, who's probably the one who gave them the heads up, ends up asking, oh, can he get the books from that library? And so a lot of them actually get saved.
Ooh. Ooh, that's good. That's really
Yeah.
good. So do we know where the library, so is the library still around? Is it still like a collection?
It is in Hereford.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. Some of the books were destroyed. So 1679, we also get a lot of book burnings,
Ooh. Ooh.
public spectacles, and people show up and like cheer, and we get something called mock solemn processions, which are like satirical Catholic processions that end with burning popes and cardinals in effigy.
Oh boy.
I know, I'm just saying all the hits right now.
Wow. Okay. Okay.
So
That's a lot. Okay. Wow.
and there's more crazy. I don't know how much time we have left, but there's more.
Oh, go for it. There's no set length on these episodes.
So we have kind of everything coming down from Parliament, all the people enforcing these rules, ratting out or trying to hunt down Catholics and Catholic sympathizers. We get one of my favorite terms being used a lot, which is popishly affected, which means like, oh, you've been infected in a sense. You either might be one or you're helping them out. But we also have our helpers, our people who are, you know, giving everyone heads up. And then we also have our resistance figures.
Oh boy.
So some of the key members are one of my favorite booksellers, Matthew Turner. Okay, he is my favorite bookseller for my book. He is a Catholic bookseller who's been operating in London since the 1660s. He had been apprenticed to Catherine of Braganza's bookseller, so he's got some royal ties. So he's involved. We've got a countess, the Countess of Powys.
Oh, okay.
Some more Welsh connections there.
Love a Welsh connection.
And we've got her servant, who is a Catholic midwife, Elizabeth Sellier. There's also an astrologer. There's also a liar. There's a whole bunch of people. It really is like Ocean's 11 putting together a crew.
I love that.
And one of them genuinely is just famous for being a liar. He turns on the rest, very unsurprisingly.
Oh, yeah. Oh, Kel Surprise. Yeah.
Yes. You're going to love his name, actually. I should mention it. The liar's name is Thomas Dangerfield.
Oh, yes.
But this whole resistance group, and there's so many more people, are really busy trying to combat the flow of misinformation by putting out their own manuscript or handwritten pamphlets, letters, and printed pamphlets and letters. We've got the five Catholic lords in the Tower writing things. Those writings are then smuggled out of the Tower of London.
Smuggling secret handwritten manuscripts out of the Tower of London. Yes, please.
Right. So they're then getting circulated. We have so many people producing ballads. That's a great way to engage in the culture at the time. So tunes, songs set to very familiar tunes.
Oh, okay, right. So like a parody song then.
Yeah, kind of like a parody song, but most often they're used to either portray morals and ideas or news. They can be very funny. They can be very doom and gloom, and they're kind of the stock in trade of how a lot of people get information.
Cool.
It's like if you get your news from TikTok and there's music playing.
Brilliant.
Mm-hmm. I should say I don't actually use TikTok, so apologies if some people are like, why? What is that comparison?
Yeah, I mean, I think most of the people listening will be aware that there is an app called TikTok. I mean, I don't use TikTok. But, oh, that's so funny. Okay, amazing. Wow, so this is a whole multimedia thing in a way then. Like, as many media as were available at the time.
Oh, yeah, and we get the speeches that Parliament is making before it's dismissed by the king. They're being printed. We have scaffold speeches. So the people are being executed. Their last words are being taken down and then printed and circulated. And Matthew Turner, the bookseller, also is selling alongside those scaffold speeches handkerchiefs that were dipped in the blood of the executed.
Oh. Wow. That's wild.
So they're little relics because these are now martyrs for the cause.
That's incredible. That's amazing. Wow. So like, yeah, I've heard of people dipping handkerchiefs in blood before. And I hadn't put together the like the relic side of it.
Mm
That's so cool. Oh, of course. Wow. Do we have any, have we got any extant examples of this? I imagine it's a very fugitive kind of artifact, like a silk or cotton handkerchief must be almost like a silk or cotton or linen handkerchief must be something that we don't have very many of from the period. But like, do we have any of these bloody handkerchiefs?
Not that I'm aware of.
Oh, okay.
We mostly know about them from other people complaining in pamphlets that this is happening.
Amazing. Damn this filth.
Or in reports from kind of authorities that have performed searches and seizures, and they'll often record like, oh, we found a trunk of Welsh primers, we found Popish knacks. They say beads, which usually means rosaries, and images. They talk about finding those a lot.
Oh, okay. So we're talking like the sort of the classic material culture of Roman Catholicism, presumably like sort of statuary and beads and books and that sort of thing
Yes.
that would be used, but are kind of used by lots of different denominations. But if you live in a time where Christianity, like state Christianity, is being stripped back to its absolute Bible and a Bible and a person in a silly collar basics, any of that might be considered Catholic. So I guess there's a lot of false kind of, I guess there must be a lot of false accusations being pointed at people. Like obviously people have died and people are being deported because of them, but there must have been an awful lot of like people just happening to wear a crucifix being accused of papism, I imagine.
There are a lot of people who are accused of being Catholic and deny this. So Anthony Wood, the very famous book collector in Oxford, he's routinely accused of being a Catholic. Denies it his whole life, does have a bunch of Catholic friends, though, that he tries to help out. And it kind of becomes this political term, like, calling someone Popish has already really long-standing been, well, you're not, we don't think you're the right kind of Christian. We don't think that you are close enough to what we think Christianity should be. So that's already really established. But when you are in 1679 and the couple of years after it, we also get the emergence of political parties in England.
Oh, wow. Okay.
The Whigs and the Tories.
Amazing. Okay, so it goes all the way back to it goes all the way back to here, and obviously the Tories are what we now call the Conservative Party in the UK. And this is where it all starts to come from.
Yes, and so the term Popish also gets caught up in this new political divide. The Whigs on the whole are for belief in the plot, for excluding James from the throne. And when we go into the early 1680s, they're winning a lot of local elections for the House of Commons. The Tories, meanwhile, are all about protecting royal authority, so they don't want any limits on royal power. They want to keep James in the succession. It is members in that group that are throwing out some doubts, and then those doubts start to escalate, and we get this whole Tory pamphlet and ballad culture that is now in 1682 to 1684 working to dismantle belief in the plot. And of course, the names themselves. Tory comes from an insult for Irish Catholics, meaning outlaw or robber. Whig, meanwhile, is an insult coming from a term for Scottish Presbyterians. So it's all bound up in religion.
Wow, I didn't know that. I did not know about the origins of the names Whig and Tory. That's news to me. That's incredible. Also, it makes me very upset that because the Tories were the ones trying to dismantle the plot, I have technically agreed with the Tories on something, and that makes me sad.
Yes, it's a very studying history is very weird. I think
Yeah.
it's if you if you study American history and you're talking about the Republican Party in the 19th century, you'll have a very different stance on party thoughts, whichever way you go.
Yeah, right. There was a big switch, wasn't there, in the 20th century, and the Republicans suddenly became the baddies. I'm not in the BBC. I don't have to be impartial. But yeah, this is what comes from studying history, is you have all of your notions, preconceived notions, challenged, which is what it's all about, right? It's all about questioning received wisdom, which is maybe what more people in 1679 should have done.
Yes, they should have.
Incredible.
You don't really get the waning of the plot until, again, some people start to date it at 1681, but that year we have a big Whig victory in the House of Commons. It's really more 1683, 84 that we get this switch and the Tory party comes out on top, and with it there's more pushback against the plot, and there's a couple of court cases. The Queen's physician, oh wait, what is his name? He has a good name too. Not as good as Thomas Dangerfield. I think he wins. George Wake, what is it? George Wakefield, I think.
George Wakefield is an okay name, but that's just a name, right? That's not Dangerfield. Dangerfield is never not going to be a good name.
Yes, right. George Wakeman. Oh my goodness. There's too
A
many names.
Wakeman. Okay.
Wakeman. He is arrested. He is put on trial for the plot, but he is found not guilty. And this was not an easy judge. This was a hard judge. And in fact, the judge then gets a lot of death threats. But this kind of starts to turn the tide. And my popish midwife, Elizabeth Sellier, she's writing all of these blasts against the plot. Oh, wait, I forgot to talk about the meal tub plot. Can I talk about the meal tub plot really quickly?
I mean, go for it.
They're in, so this whole group, the Countess, Elizabeth Sellier, the astrologer, the liar, are desperate to change belief in the plot. So they think, well, we know the plot is fake, but if we can pin the plot, the invention of it, on another group that people don't like, then maybe people will start doubting it. And so they come up with a plan to frame a group of Presbyterians for the plot. But this is discovered when papers found hidden in the bottom of a meal tub are uncovered. And this is the meal tub plot.
A meal t so a grain barrel.
Yes.
Okay.
So Elizabeth Sellier is also arrested for this. She gets arrested several times. She is not convicted on her first trial, and then she publishes a bunch of works called Malice Defeated, where she brags about how she, won her trial. Then she gets sued for libel for that, is fined and forced to stand at the pillory.
Oh, amazing. Okay.
And then the king steps in and is like, no, you don't have to pay that fine. And you don't have to continue serving at the pillory. You've done enough. So that has happened. We get the trials, the tide starts to turn. More people start to get arrested for making up bits of the plot. And then we have the Rye House plot.
Oh my goodness. Okay. So we're just starting to get over this thing, and people are actually starting to be prosecuted for making something up that has already resulted in deaths. Like, people have died, lost their homes and businesses, been forced abroad, and now there's another but coming. Okay, cool. What year are we in? What year is this latest?
1683.
Okay, so we're 4 years later. Oh my goodness. Okay, we're 4 years later. Cool. So what happens now?
So the Rye House plot
This is
is
so mad. All of this is so crazy.
the Rye House plot is a genuine plot to assassinate Charles the King and his brother James. And it is the plan of a small group of Whigs.
Okay.
It's a legend, but I say that a real plot in terms of in contrast to the completely fictitious Popish plot.
Oh, okay, yeah, this is a actual plot.
Yes.
Right.
By a small group. This is discovered, and this is kind of what flips the switch for people, because people start to realize, oh my gosh, we're going so far in this direction. We've come so close to restarting that civil war a couple of times. And now the other side is trying to do some executions or some assassinations. Maybe we need to rethink this.
Oh wow, okay. Oh my giddy
And
aunt. Okay.
it's crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah, this is fully wild stuff happening. This is just being made up. Some of this stuff has just been made up. Like, okay, there are legit plots happening. There are always legitimate plots happening. But
Yeah.
what blows my mind is like there've been civil wars in the British Isles in the 1640s and 50s that have caused thousands and thousands and thousands of deaths, and the political landscape has been changed permanently. And then 1660s, we have fires and we have plagues, and then 1670s, all of a sudden somebody's like, oh, by the way, the Catholics are at it again. Like it's just my guy, could you not? Like, we've had such a 25 years, can you just not?
Yes. And it's so crazy because to talk about the Popish plot, suddenly we're talking about exclusion crisis. Then we have the meal tub plot, which is like a reverse plot to blame someone else, and then the Rye House plot, which is a real assassination plot. It's the rise of political parties. It's a
Yeah.
great thing.
This is an incredible, and this is what, over the course of what, 5, 10 years, this is a huge upheaval. It's absolutely amazing. So how does the Rye House plot all play out? Does that just fizzle and the perpetrators are dealt with?
Yes. So people are arrested for it. Some of the people flee into exile over to Amsterdam, which is very sympathetic to the Whig cause, foreshadowing for a different year. But yeah, that really turns public opinion around. And by 1684, most people have turned against the Popish plot. And that guy who started it all, Titus Oates, is prosecuted for libel. James, the Duke of York, leads a
Oh.
case against
Incredible. And it's libel, a criminal offence that exists to this day that is basically just spreading lies.
And in this case, it's seditious libel. So it's spreading lies with the intent to cause rebellion.
Ooh, okay, seditious libel. Outstanding. So what happens to him?
So he is found guilty. He is sentenced to life in prison and to be pilloried 5 times a year.
Oh, that's incredible. He has to, so for people not listening, the pillory is it's the wooden planks with the holes in them that you put your head and hands or your feet through, right? And that's the classic kind of you're out in public being embarrassed and also in a stress position being pelted or being, and people died at the pillories, right? People died at the pillory because you're outside in a stress position for days at a time, sometimes being pelted with fruit and veg in all weathers. And if you're an elderly person or you're somebody with a chronic illness, you just can't handle that kind of punishment.
Some people have their ears nailed to the pillory as well, and then they're cut off.
Oh, that's grim.
So,
Oh.
yep, he's charged with sedition, seditious libel, perjury. He's also whipped at one point on his way to the pillory.
Oh my goodness. This poor dude. Well, I say this poor dude, he's responsible for the deaths of several people, but oof, that's brutal.
Yeah, I don't really feel bad for this man.
No, I don't feel bad for him, but oof, it's not a nice thing. So does he complete his sentence?
No, he does not. Because it, the next year, James, the Duke of York, becomes King James the Seventh and Second. But 3 years later, he is overthrown by his daughter Mary and his son-in-law, William of Orange, coming over from the Netherlands.
The Glorious Revolution.
I like to call it the 1688 Revolution, but
Yes.
back to the Whig history.
Ooh, okay, so the 1688 Revolution. Okay, and that is a good thing for Titus Oates.
Yes, he is pardoned and he is granted a pension which starts paying out in 1698. So he gets £300 a year from 1698 to his death in 1705.
Oh wow! It's, how much money is that in today's money? I'm gonna figure it out.
Oh no, I don't know.
It's okay. That's what the internet is for. That is why we have the internet. Somebody has done a tool for this. I know somebody's done a tool for this. Right. I might be lying. Oh yeah. Here we go. This is a thing that exists. No, I don't. No, I'm not going to download an XLS file. Why would I want to download something? The internet, you crazy loon. All right. 1698 to now, money. Inflation calculator. That's handy. Thanks to the Bank of England. I'm going to try and figure this out because this sounds like it would be a fun
How
thing.
much does?
Okay, 1698, right?
Yes.
So £300 in 1698. I have broken Bank of England's calculator, and it will not show me. Come on, the Bank of England, you could do this. You weren't even around in 1698. Maybe. I don't know. Oh wow. Okay. So, oh my God. So he was given £43,500 a year.
Oh my gosh.
That's incredible. He got 43 and a half grand a year for
That's
being.
more than a lot of professors make.
That's more than I make in a year. That's crazy. That's for being a liar. Literally for being a liar.
And
Oh.
a bad liar. I haven't talked about it, but like the plot is ridiculous when you read it, especially all the add-ons.
That's. Just that makes me angry. How dare he? That's totally wild. Why would he be paid? Why would he be paid so much money?
Because he had been harassing James, and after the 1688 revolution, it's cool to hate on James again.
Oh, wow. That's depressing. Okay, so
I feel like I should throw out as well. There's so much good that comes out of the Whig Party. I am speaking when I critique them very much the actions of 1679, and then Whig history, which is a version of history told from the perspective of like this positivist, progressive history of everything that Britain does is advancing and improving it, and that's how you have to tell history. You know,
Okay.
they never do bad things, they just do good things that enhance their reputation and are slowly bringing Britain to the modern world.
Okay. Well, yeah. Yeah. Okay.
So that's why, like, the Glorious Revolution. That's a very Whig history term. That's very,
yeah,
also very English perspective.
Well, indeed.
Agree.
No, that's the thing is, and this is a time where we've had the union of the crowns, right? The Irish, well, the Scottish and the English crowns. And this is a time where, like, the idea of Britishness as a monolithic thing is starting to be born as well, right? This is the start. This is working to, and it's only, you know, a decade or two before the United Kingdom becomes an entity. So this is a time where the idea of unity and bringing things forward and, like, oh, look, we're in this shiny new 18th century. Ooh, look, Union Jacks. Like, this is all in its infancy, right? This is the nascence of it all.
Yes, yeah.
Oh, I hate it. I hate all of it so much, but it's so fascinating.
Mm-hmm. It really is. It really is fascinating. And just, yes, it's so easy to draw very relevant parallels to today. And, you know, 4 years plus can seem like a short time in many ways, but it's a long time to be living with this constant fear of, are you going to be investigated? Is your shop going to be raided? Are you going to be arrested? We have all these petitions from families saying, you know, please release this person, we need them to survive. So it's a lot of really splitting up of families, and not just to the Catholic communities. A lot of groups that are viewed with suspicion come under attack during this time. You know, it's a time that reinforces this idea of conformity. And we also, on the resistance side, have a lot of non-Catholics who are pitching in to try to show the plot's not real.
Wow. Yeah, it's incredible. Thank you for this wonderful 17th century fake news and disinformation primer. This is so fascinating. And like you say, the parallels that can be drawn to today are kind of frightening. Like, it's scary that this stuff still happens. Like, on a daily basis, this is still happening to us. So I guess we can, like, take some things from this, right? Like, check your sources, do a little bit of research, do a little bit of homework before you just believe what you're told in a broadside or in a ballad or what you hear down the ale house on a Saturday night, which is, of course, the Thursday of the weekend.
Are you only getting your news from one source? Are you getting it from one perspective? How are you feeling? What's your knee-jerk reaction to things? I mean, you even have parallels in merchandising.
Oh my goodness, yeah, that's so true. Oh, you do, yeah.
You can get Popish Plot dinner plates at the time.
Oh, that's incredible, and I want one.
I do want one too, actually.
Yeah, I would love one of those. I could probably get a replica made. That sounds amazing. Oh, how fantastic. Amazing. All right, well, Chelsea, thank you so much for being amazing and having all of this wonderful information to hand. Absolutely fabulous. Do you have anything that you would like to plug?
I guess just keep an eye out for my first book. It's not out yet, but hopefully it will be out from Boydell and Brewer by the end of the year.
Woo! An amazing name to have putting your book out. And remind us what the name of the book is.
The name of the book is Catholic Print Networks in Restoration London, 1660 to 1688.
Amazing. Wonderful stuff. Dr. Chelsea Rutke from the University of Utah and everywhere else that I know you from as well. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Yay! All right, I'm going to stop recording.
Steeped in History is a podcast hosted on the Audio Boom Network. It's presented by Jimmy Johnson, edited by Jimmy Johnson and his friend Sam, produced by Jimmy Johnson, and features music by Inaban. I think that's pretty much it for the credits.